Group meeting, Saturday, 7th February, 1987. We are now coming to the end of Chapter 5. Last time, we saw, this is the point at which we stopped, that in the state of communion, which comes into being when the sense functions and the discursive mind are quite silent, the state of communion is one of complete silence. The brain has stopped chattering. When out of communion, the talking mind never stops its incessant chatter, except in profound slumber. Otherwise, the brain continues to mull over the events of the day, the problems of the day, the unfinished things, the unanswered questions, and so forth. The brain goes on, but we are not conscious of it in our dreams as such. That is to say, we are not conscious that this is the mechanism which goes on in dreams. We are conscious of our dreams, of course. And those two we tend to forget when we wake up. But in truly profound slumber, the dreamless state, then we are in that state of unconscious communion. That is the trouble, that is the difficulty. Although we are in communion, we don't know it. The state of communion is the state of the transcendent knowing of our complete unity with the totality. But we are not awake to it. We cannot realize it, therefore, when we wake up. It's gone. But it has its influence, especially where health is concerned. That aspect of sleep is the great refreshing and rejuvenating part of sleep. The sleep of the part of dreamless slumber. Now, as regards the chatter, it is mainly verbal. When not verbal, it consists of a succession of sense impressions, visual or auditory or according to any of the other senses. It also includes the restless confusion of memories and indulgence in anticipation. During our waking state, we indulge in a good deal of anticipation. If I do this, if I do that, then this will happen. We'll go and do this tomorrow, next week, next year. It's all useless nonsense. What happens, happens. We have to learn to be fully awake now. If we are fully awake now, all memory of the past doesn't trouble us. It is there, we can recall it if necessary, but it doesn't trouble us anymore. Not only is all memory of the past not there, but that is the complete end of indulging in anticipation. And if we look into the thought process in our ordinary everyday life, we will see that all this is concerned entirely with oneself and with obtaining pleasure for oneself, success for oneself, and so on. In profound slumber, self-consciousness is perforce temporarily cut off. That is, the consciousness of I am I and not anything else or anybody else. The separative, isolative self-consciousness, which is our great trouble from the time the human race came into being. The separative, isolative self-consciousness. And it is that which, through evolution, an evolution which has to be helped, it won't take place on its own unless we see that we ought to cooperate in this way. Helped by living the religious life in the true sense. Not regarding the religious life simply as a life of ritual, of laid down self-sacrifice and all the rest of it. Nor is it a life of contemplation with the object of gaining some reward for ourselves, namely the fruition of our own consciousness and its fulfillment. And we think of it always in terms of something extraordinarily happy. It is nothing of the sort. It is something which is all-inclusive. All the sorrow, conflict, misery, trouble, pain of life, of existence, as well as all that we feel and enjoy as pleasure, joy, success, all that is included in it. It is an all-inclusive consciousness. When we have that all-inclusive consciousness, we reject nobody, we reject nothing. Even the so-called evil things. Because as long as I reject what I call evil, I cannot really do what is the best thing possible to transform the evil into good. I can't do it. It is only in the relationship of complete acceptance, acceptance without any criticism, without approval, without disapproval, which releases out of one's own consciousness an extraordinary power of love, which is the true transcendent love, which does the healing. It is a power which cannot be described. But if and when you experience it at any time, and the best occasions for experiencing that sort of things are the unhappy occasions. Supposing some member of the family is at loggerheads with you. Definitely inimical to you. And you see that person suffering from some illness or pain. And just seeing there emerges a tremendous flow of compassion. Just compassion. No, not wishing, I wish your cancer or whatever it is will be healed and you will be free from pain. Pain will always come. That's part of existence. But just compassion, accepting all that is happening. The very word compassion means just that. Completely accepting everything. So, in profound slumber, this separative self-consciousness is cut off. It is a temporary death. The death which holds within itself the mystery of regeneration, not death the destroyer. Here we are restored to communion, but this is an unknowing communion, a communion without attention. You know how in Upanishadic teaching they present Brahman as Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat meaning being, Chit meaning attention, an attention which is constant. It is not unaware of anything whatsoever in Brahman's entire universe. And Ananda means bliss. But you see, in our human languages, we have limited the meaning of bliss to that which is agreeable, acceptable, pleasurable. This is a mistake. You will know bliss through the intensity of pain and grief just as much as through the intensity of what is agreeable and pleasurable. You know how it is said of martyrs throughout the world's history that they died in ecstasy. Now, if I'm the victim of the Spanish Inquisition and I'm being burnt at the stake, can you imagine that I could possibly be in bliss? But it is bliss. Because this extraordinary power of acceptance of totality, whatever happens, which is your consciousness in that situation, is the thing which is blissful, and you are fully awake to it, although you will feel the pain. See, this is the magic, the magical power of the creative energy of transcendence. When not asleep bodily, the discursive mind stops talking and attentiveness is at its intensest. We are wholly awake and silent. This is the communion which is the transcendental realization of truth, of the infinite, of the eternal, which you, as the particular individual organism, can experience as an egoless being. The word egoless must not be understood in the sense in which some people present it, that we have to destroy the ego. Nothing of the sort. Our first task is to realize perfect egohood. Egohood, the perfect egohood, specifically means that the whole of the psychophysical organism is realized as a harmony. Every part of us is rightly related to every other part of us. The rightness not being predetermined by the brain. Rightness is much more than what we ordinarily consider right. This is good, this is pleasurable, this is agreeable. It's not just that. It's this total acceptance. Now, this is perfect egohood. And that, after realizing that, you realize the supreme individuality, that is, the indivisibility between yourself and the totality. You can extend that. Those of you who remember, we used to practice this earth meditation when we extended our sense of the oneness towards all humanity. And in extending it that way, we realized that the 24-hour day, the 24-hour day of man is one moment of the earth. Because you go right around the world and all the 5,000 million human beings are doing and thinking and feeling and speaking different things. And if you can feel, if you can just visualize them, see them as such, and take them as such, and put yourself in right relationship, then you have realized true individuality, indivisibility, as far as the human race is concerned. Extend that to all the kingdoms of nature. Extend that to all that there is in the whole universe. And you will have the same sort of indivisible, holistic consciousness, which is the divine consciousness. Now, this state, free of separativeness, is the one source which is the living root of all religion. Here, all the teachers are one. Out of this unitary truth, there grow and proliferate the different religions. Because the perfected Holy One lives in a particular place, at a particular time, in a particular culture. And therefore, all those aspects exercise a limiting influence upon what he will present. You see, but at root, he has realized justice, this holistic consciousness, which is all-inclusive, which rejects nothing. After the transcendent experiencing, back in ordinary consciousness, those who realized were aware that no discourse spoken aloud as audible speech or spoken silently as thought could contain or could express unerringly this experience. Their whole being was saturated with bliss, with peace, with love, with enlightenment, with deathlessness. And they saw with clear sight that the words and conceptions associated with man's escapist longings, named bliss or love or immortality, were not the real which they had experienced, or rather, which the real had manifested through their experiencing. We are the apparatus, the instruments of transcendence, through which transcendence manifests its unitary wholeness. And in the process of manifestation, like a prism will split up white light into several colors, this one reality of transcendence gets split up. We are like prisms. We split up that wholeness into innumerable different things, which remain unrelated in our mind and consciousness. And hence the confusion and the contradictions and the miseries and so on. Wisely, those holy ones affirmed that the real was not this, not that, the famous neti neti doctrine of Yajnavalkya, which comes in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Not this, not that, not that. That supreme is just indescribable. But since the love call of their disciples who hungered and thirsted could not be denied, many an affirmation of the great religions of the past took the form they did. The sons of the worthy ones, ready for the esoteric teaching, understood and profited. I think I've explained this before. The sons doesn't mean the son of the flesh, but those disciples who were almost at the same level or very near the level of the Holy One himself, they were always called the sons. The Buddha, for example, openly says, you'll find it in the Udana, I think it's page 184 or 188. Yes. You are the sons of my mouth. You see? The perfected Holy One was himself present to correct and help them. Thus for them there was no intrusion by the sorrow of time, of psychological and not chronological time, upon the bliss of eternity. Psychological time we create all along the line. We produce it according to our mood, according to our reaction. That is why the technique of religious living, desirelessness is emphasized so much. Because desire can either be fulfilled or not fulfilled. We should not seek the fulfillment of what we call good desires or holy desires and so forth. Whatever we seek as such is separative. It cuts tongues off. Let be. Let life go on. Whatever happens, see, look into it, understand it. Literally, stand under it, underlie it. In that underlying, you are at one with the transcendent power which upholds the universe. The devil, Satan, is usually presented as down there. Actually, God is down there, rather than Satan. The underlying reality. But there were many others who were in thrall to the sorrow of time. Driven though they were by the pain of being out of communion, they could not shake free from the shackling demands of intellect, from the craving for a verbal construct that would lay down a logical doctrine and point to a goal to be reached by a mortal person in time. Not one of us will ever reach anything in time, because time is the instrument of death, the process of death. Time goes on and on and on and ends. And in its going on, there is the perpetual ending of that which went before. You see? It's like that. So alas, devoid of the Holy One's wisdom and skill and inspiring presence, the lesser teachers spoke learnedly. Beware of the learned man. He can hypnotize you with his learning. The wise man will not only not hypnotize you, he will allow you and help you to be awake. God of the transcendent was the other than oneself. This is, of course, the great drawback of all theistic theologies. God is that other chap, somebody else. And you look at the descriptions given, they are always just myself in apotheosis. Myself in perfection. What I would like to be. If God is not what I would like to be, he's not God, obviously. If there's time, I'll read you a poem by Rupert Brooke, which is very relevant to this point. Union with the transcendent, or fellowship with God, was the goal at the end of a way. There was a method, a discipline, a practice of holy living, which constituted the way. The words symbolizing the goal, such as Brahman or God or truth or immortality or peace or bliss, were taken in their conceptual meanings by their followers. That is, as the opposite of the other component of a duality, namely the devil or falsity or death or turmoil or sorrow. Thus, they sowed the seeds of the errors and confusions bedeviling all theologies. Conceptual meanings. Whenever we use these words, God, truth, immortality, peace, bliss, and so forth, each one of us has his or her own meaning to it. We, being limited, can only give rise to limited meanings. Of course, that is our starting point. We cannot avoid that. If you want to take a step forward, you have to be standing on the step which will be left behind, wouldn't you? But realize that the step on which you are standing is the step from which you move away. But we have fixed meanings to all these things. It is these mental fixations which are the very devil. Nevertheless, in spite of the fact that the errors and confusions have bedeviled theologies, the pure heart of religion throbs through the bruised body of Scripture. It is for each man to listen, to watch, to understand, and to be in communion. That finishes the first part of the book. 61 pages, and there are 338 to follow. And we've taken 2 years over it. I'll read you that poem by Rupert Brooke. The poem is called Heaven. The title is Heaven. And Rupert Brooke is describing heaven as conceived by fish. You know that poem. Fish, fly replete in depth of June, dawdling away their watery noon, ponder deep wisdom, dark or clear, each secret, fishy hope or fear. Fish say they have their stream and pond, but is there anything beyond? This life cannot be all, they swear, for how unpleasant if it were. One may not doubt that somehow good shall come of water and of mud, and sure the reverent eye must see a purpose in liquidity. We darkly know by faith, we cry, the future is not wholly dry. Mud unto mud, death eddies near, not here the appointed end, not here, but somewhere beyond space and time is wetter water, slimier slime. And there, they trust, there swimmeth one who swam ere rivers were begun, immense, of fishy form and mind, squamous, omnipotent and kind. And under the almighty fin, the littlest fish may enter in. Oh, never fly conceals a hook, fish say, in the eternal brook. But more than mundane weeds are there, and mud celestially fair. Fat caterpillars drift around, and paradisal grubs are found. Unfading moths, immortal flies, and the worm that never dies. And in that heaven of all their wish, there shall be no more land, say fish. Isn't this lovely?